snow is falling in Anchorage. It's a perfect day for our topic today, which is Eowyn Ivey's lovely, wonderful, and amazingly successful Alaskan book, The Snow Child. It's Anchorage Reads is the name of the library program. Our show is called Hometown Alaska. My name's Charles Wolforth, and today we're going to be doing a book group on the air. We're going to be talking about this novel, and we're going to hope to get questions from folks who have read the novel, have comments or insights about it or questions for its author. And it's rather than just a typical author interview like you hear on NPR every 5 minutes or so, we're going to hopefully get really deeply into this extraordinary book. And so I'm so honored to have in the studio with me today, Eowyn Ivey from Palmer. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm really thrilled to be on here. This is a great show and my favorite radio station.
Oh, excellent. And you've kind of been a world globe-trotting, book-touring author, kind of living the dream recently.
Yeah, it has actually been just a completely thrilling and surprising year. It came out in the hardcover format almost exactly a year ago today, so it's been a whirlwind and lots of fun.
Mm-hmm. And you're doing Anchorage Reads, so you're doing a bunch of events around town, talking with readers and getting feedback about the book. How's that been going?
It's been so much fun. We've done lots of different activities. Last Saturday, I was out at Lusac Library with lots of families, building snowmen, ice sculptures, beautiful ice sculptures, hot cocoa, all the good stuff. But we're also doing some other events with 49 writers coming up on Saturday, and then the following Saturday, kind of reading and Q&A. So there's lots of fun activities coming up, I think.
Great. And listeners who want to learn more about some of those activities and events that are coming up, if you'll go on our website, which is alaskapublic.org, and scroll down to Anchorage Reads The Snow Child, you'll find a page for today's show, which has a link to Eowyn's page and some reviews, and then also a schedule of the Anchorage Reads events that are coming up. And, you know, for today, it's your chance to get on the air and talk to Eowyn and ask her questions and let her know what you think of The Snow Child. I know a lot of people have read and are reading the book. It's all over town. So to get on the air with us, call 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And to get on by email, hometown@alaskapublic.org, hometown@alaskapublic.org, and we will read your comments on the air where we have time to do so, and share it with Eowyn, the author. So, you know, when the book opens, well, maybe we should sort of give a quick precis or summary of the plot for those who haven't read it. Mabel is basically a bereaved, I would say middle age. You talked to her about her being an old woman. She's about maybe 50 or so.
Yeah. And that was kind of a, you know, the original fairy tale talks about an old man and an old woman. And I had to kind of walk that line of what would be realistic as far as the age of a couple that would move to Alaska and homestead. So I've gotten a little bit of teasing about how old is old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, at being 49, I was like, hey, wait a minute. But, be that as it may, they move to homestead on what seems to be the Matanuska River, maybe a bit north of Palmer.
Yeah, what I did is, you know, originally that's exactly where I was setting it, with keeping in mind the coal mines north of there and the train tracks. But I was becoming a little obsessed with the geography, and so I kind of invented my own place, the Wolverine River and the town of Alpine. But anyone who's been in the valley will recognize a lot of
similarities. And there was a historic town called Alpine there, wasn't there?
Well, yeah, actually Sutton has a lot of place names having to do with Alpine, so I definitely borrowed from that. And I spent the first years of my life in Alaska near the Wolverine Lake and Wolverine Creek on the Lazy Mountain. So I did a little homage to a few of my favorite places.
Oh, neat. So in any event, Mabel and her husband, Jack, had a stillborn child, and they're still grieving this a decade later, and have gone to Alaska to get away from their grief, in a sense. And they're having a very hard time trying to homestead. And then early in their experience, they build this little snow child that seems to come to life and have a child of their own over that winter and then over time that precedes. Mm-hmm. And it's a you might call it a magical realism in the tradition of Gabriel Garcia Marquez or Borges or one of those writers, except that there's quite a tension between believing and not believing. And most of those Latin American books, just everybody automatically believes. Was that, or were you sort of familiar with those, with that tradition, and were you playing off that at all?
You know, I am familiar with that tradition, but I wasn't really thinking in those terms. Because as you say, someone like Marquez, someone just suddenly up and flies in the middle of his books and is throughout. Whereas in mine, I just wanted the one magical element and to have some questioning of what was real and what wasn't real. So I do think it's a little bit different, but certainly an honor to be considered within, you know, that context.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And really, one of the main themes of the book is this: how do we deal with grief? How do we get beyond grieving and start living again and moving into the next stage of life? And was that a theme that you knew from the start you really wanted to be writing about?
Well, it's interesting because it started out with just that simple fairy tale of an old man and a woman who can't have a child. And I've been fortunate. We've got two beautiful daughters, and I've been very blessed that way. But I did know that I wanted death, both in terms of the wilderness and in our own lives, to be part of that theme. And unfortunately, as I was writing it, I did lose a very dear friend to cancer. She was the same age as me. So I think it just sort of resonated all the more of how do we cope, as you say, with grief, with loss.
Mm-hmm. And sort of the renewal and rebirth, because it's very affirming, and the ending is, I think, a good topic of debate, which I'm sure we'll get into, but it's not at all, in my mind, a really sad ending. I mean, the affirmation and the renewal of life is all there.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. But yeah, you're right. The ending is always an interesting topic of discussion for people, I think.
Okay. And the vision of Alaska is an interesting one as well, and comparing it to other books. You know, it's very kind of brutal and rough as we get started, and then it seems gets softer maybe as Mabel gets more accustomed to it. But in the beginning, it reminded me a bit of Seth Kantner's book, Ordinary Wolves, that this, you know, this, which was a slap in the face for sort of the literary world, because we're used to Alaska being portrayed in this softer vein, and here it is almost unbearably tough in his book. And you know, one of the most engaging scenes to me in The Snow Child was when Mabel is walking out on the ice, and you know, what an opening scene when she's trying to commit suicide by falling through the ice.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I, of course, I'm thrilled to hear you mention Ordinary Wolves. It's one of my very favorite Alaskan books. And I think that, you know, having grown up here, I love this place. And one of the things, though, I wanted to do was to look at the landscape very honestly and then imagine how someone new would feel about it. And then how could they still fall in love with it, even seeing it in an honest light? So I'm glad that you picked up on that theme in there.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, that scene on the ice is extraordinary, because it seems so, it's very vivid that she has the intent of killing herself, and then when she doesn't fall through the ice, she suddenly doesn't want to anymore, which I think is a very common theme in that kind of situation.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah. And I'm one of these fortunate people that I don't suffer from depression. I've never felt that way before.
Everyone thinks the book is about you, don't they?
Yeah, I do get that sometimes. But I really find what I love about fiction, both reading it and writing it, is empathy, of trying to understand. So I think we've all felt sadness. So then you take it to the furthest out there as far as you can, and imagine how Mabel would feel. And it was hard for me, actually, in ways, to write that scene. But I wanted to truly understand who she was and what she was going through.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's kind of expository too, because it's sort of telling you, who is this woman and what is she going through right now?
Right. Absolutely.
But it's also just very vividly described, and the emotion, it comes through very strongly. So if it's a work of imagination purely, I'm very impressed. You know?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm fortunate enough that it is. Now, yeah. I have been on river ice that I've been a little wary about being on, but I was never out there hoping to fall through, I can tell you that.
Yeah. I mean, that would be the most nightmarish way to commit suicide I could imagine.
Yeah, I think it would be rather unpleasant, absolutely.
So you're a lifelong Alaskan?
I am. My parents moved up here from Colorado when I was about 3 or 4, so mm-hmm. really my entire memory life is here in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. See, I'm in the same situation. And when at book jackets, I always say lifelong Alaskan. My mother always said, oh, that's a lie.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I have sometimes people will say, oh, born and raised. I'm like, I don't know. I can't quite claim all the way back there.
Well, I want to let listeners know that I'm not going to hog the conversation. I really want to hear your thoughts and comments about The Snow Child. We're kind of co-hosting Hometown Alaska and Anchorage Reads, the Anchorage Public Library's program today. And the phone number here is 550-8433. That's within Anchorage Ball. From outside Anchorage, it's toll-free at 1-888-3 353-5752. And email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And I got one email before the show began, which is I have to read, and I'm sure Awen may be blushing here, but it'll be fun. I'll just read it, who it's from, at the very end. Awen is often asked why so many people from around the world have latched onto the snow child. It is a difficult question because it forces you to seem vain. She is definitely too modest of a person to answer fully. On the other hand, don't have to be modest and can at least hint at just one area that draws readers in. One of my favorite lines that transcends a lot of the book is what Mabel's sister puts in a letter from Pennsylvania. In my old age, I see that life itself is often more fantastic and terrible than the stories we believed as children, and that perhaps there is no harm in finding magic among the trees. It's fun finding happiness and love out of dark moments that, ironically, life becomes richer and fuller, not just by its ups, but by its downs as well. Awen has received comments from readers who have expressed that this theme has helped them out of personal moments of loss or similar dark place. Some older, mature readers have been delighted by Awen's understanding of what an older couple's relationship might be like and have enjoyed the rekindling of Jack and Mabel's romance, a marriage made stronger by their past experiences. With love and hopefully not too much embarrassment, your husband. And then he says, P.S. Happy birthday.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm about the luckiest person in the world to have Sam as my husband. And he's been behind me all the way on this book. So that I am blushing and I'm also very touched.
Yes. And so it's your birthday today. I don't know if you want to tell everybody. It's a big
Well,
one.
It's actually, it's the big 4-0 this year. So, it's one of those landmark ones.
Yeah, see, not too long from now, you're going to be just to the age of Jack
and
Mabel.
No, absolutely.
And you'll say, maybe I exaggerated a little bit.
Exactly. Absolutely.
And so he's a biologist.
He is. He's a fishery biologist with the Palmer office there. And we were high school sweethearts and have been together for a long time, happily. So.
Oh, that's great. So you obviously spent a lot of time outdoors then.
I did. And actually, it's interesting because a lot of that had to do with my husband. I grew up in a family that did a lot of hunting and fishing. And then that was part of our relationship as we started. I think one of our first dates was going rabbit hunting. And so it's very much a part of our lives, continuing with our daughters, that same lifestyle.
Uh-huh. And do you live way out in the country?
Well, you know, it's so funny because I'm always cautious when I answer this question because by Alaska standards, we almost live in the suburbs. You know, we're on the road system. We live in Chicoloon, so about, 30 miles northeast of Palmer. But when I'm talking to people in other places, I try to accurately describe it so they understand that, we can't see any of our neighbors. And we were fortunate enough to get a very nice moose in our yard. And so we're out, but it's by Alaska standards, it's not the wilderness.
Yeah. Well, that must be a great place to be a writer.
I feel very fortunate that way. Absolutely. I think it is nice to have some peace and quiet to do that kind of writing. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about the mixture of fantasy and reality in this book, which is such an important part of it. And and get sort of your sense of what is real and what's not real to some level. And I was really lucky as a younger person to interview Eudora Welty. And, her books have this sense of almost magical realism, of fantasy, things that take place that couldn't really happen. And yet when I was talking to her, saying, well, where does your fiction come from? She says, well, it's just a totally real reflection of reality. And I said, well, none of that sort of, I don't know where you're from, but that sort of thing doesn't really happen to me. Do you feel the same way about this? I mean, are you really reflecting reality, but just using a different tool to reflect it? Or
It's interesting. I think what happened, I had been working on a completely different novel that was very much just modern realism. It did not have any fantastical or magical elements before I started writing The Snow Child. And in ways, I was frustrated and I was bored with it. And part of the realization in discovering the fairy tale that kind of set me off on writing The Snow Child was this notion that, wait a minute, this is fiction. I can do whatever I want to. And so I can introduce a little bit of magic into a very realistic world. And so that was part of what was really fun for me. And it was a very big discovery for me as a writer, I think, that to open up that freedom to do that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So it's something that's allowing you to say more or say something, a different kind of truth?
Yeah, I love that idea. I think that is true, that I think, as a journalist, sometimes I felt confined by facts. I felt like in ways I wasn't getting to tell the whole story. And in fiction, you can tell things that aren't literally true, but really end up hopefully revealing truths that are a little bit slippery or harder to grasp with facts.
Yeah, and I mean, if you were really just writing about a grieving couple coming to sort of terms with their grief and renewing their life, and doing it in a totally realistic sense, that might be a tough read,
It'd be kind
really.
of a drag, I
But
think.
yeah, I mean, I
Yeah,
don't want to be,
absolutely.
you know.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, we have a call now from Lizzie in Anchorage. Lizzie,
Hello.
go right ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Lizzie. Do you have a question for Eowyn?
Yeah, well, I write science fiction, and I'm currently trying to get published. But I want to know about Eowyn's experience, how she came about to take the big jump to write the book, and how it went with getting it published.
Sure. Yeah. Hi, Lizzie. Yeah, I've always been a writer in some form or another. I was a newspaper journalist for almost 10 years, and on the side was always trying to write some fiction. And to kind of make a long story short, I ended up meeting an agent at the Kachemak Bay Writers Conference, and this is definitely a big shout out to that conference. It's a wonderful event down in Homer every summer, and they bring in agents and editors from around the country. And that was kind of where I got my break, really. He read the first 100 pages and offered to represent it, and then it took off from there. So I highly recommend conferences as a great place to meet other writers and get some opportunities like that.
So, yeah, how did you decide to write that book?
Well, I've always wanted to write fiction, and I had been writing some different short stories and working on a different novel when I came across, actually, Barbara LaVallee had illustrated a little children's picture book that was about the Snegurochka fairy tale, the Snow Maiden fairy tale. And that's sort of what kicked my imagination into gear, and I wrote it based on that.
Well, thank you.
Thank you,
All right.
and good luck with your efforts. I hope it goes well.
Thanks, Lizzie. I suppose you probably get to hear from a lot of people who want to see their work in print.
Yeah, I do. And it can be a long, frustrating process for a lot of us, I think, that you feel like you're kind of working in a vacuum and you don't know if anything's ever going to come of it. And I guess I've just found for me, before this amazing event happened with getting it published, I just tried to write for myself to just because I loved the actual process and to try to enjoy that part of it as much as I could. But it is an arduous, the publishing process can be quite challenging.
Well, do you feel like The Snow Child was a quantum leap in quality above the other work you'd done previously, or was it just something that's captured the imagination of the editors and the public?
I would like to think it was both. I think I knew an exciting premise when I came across it. I was really thrilled about the idea once I hit on it. And then I would like to think that 5 years I had invested in another novel was kind of my practice run, that hopefully I honed my skills a little bit. But I've never really shared that first novel with anyone. I think it's you know it's abandoned at this point, so.
And it just became, it just didn't speak to you, or.
Yeah, there's aspects of it that I still am attached to. I love some of the characters, and I've actually gone back and written some short stories based on those characters. But I think really back to that whole magical element, that was the key that I was missing. The thing that just felt like it really struck a chord and got me excited about the premise was this idea that I could have a little bit of magic in there.
Do you think that a little girl really could survive in the wilderness in Alaska?
This is such a great question. I'm so glad. You know what? This is one of those questions I never get asked, and I'm so glad you asked it. Starting out, I actually had many chapters written from Faina's perspective because I wanted to prove that it was possible for a girl who was 9 or 10 and had been raised in a very self-sufficient subsistence lifestyle that she could survive. I ended up stripping those out because it kind of took away some of her magic. That was my agent's insight, and I thought he was absolutely right. So we don't know Faina that well, but I always would like to think that it is possible.
And what, how, you know, it would just be a matter of extraordinary outdoor skill, you think, and self-reliance. And then she does have a shelter that she can retreat to, though we don't really know in the book. It's left somewhat ambiguous as to how much time she's actually spent inside.
Right. And I think as a lot of kids, I was fascinated when I was a little girl with the idea of children who could survive by their own wit and will. And, the Boxcar Children and Julie of the Wolves and Island of the Blue Dolphins. I could go on and on. And I remember as a little girl hearing a story about a little boy and who had just had a few marshmallows to survive on for a week and he'd made it. So I was always the kind to root for those children out there that were, living in the wilds.
Well, I mean, it struck me at a certain point that although this obviously is not a juvenile book, you could actually have written it that way.
Yeah, and it's actually been really fun because I've gotten some feedback from young adults, I'd say like 15, 16, 17, who have read it and enjoyed it, which I was really touched about because the main couple is an older couple. I'll say older as I near that 50 mark. But so I didn't expect them to be able to connect with it. But I'm glad that some, and of course, my oldest daughter was very much a part of the writing process and has read it in many different forms. And she's almost 14 now. So it's I'm glad that it has reached some of the younger people as well.
Yeah, there's nothing inappropriate about it for a teenager.
No, absolutely not. I mean, I think some of the hunting and trapping scenes can be a little bit difficult for some people who aren't familiar with that lifestyle, and a few very mild swear words. But other than that, it's not anything.
Yeah,
too.
I mean, the existence of sex is alluded to, but that's
about it. Yeah, I'm a little vague. I guess, really, that wasn't my own prudishness as much as it's funny, when I got partway into the story, I felt like the story had a certain tone that could have been ruined by things that venture too far in certain directions. So I try to stay true to that tone.
Yeah. Well, you're bringing up so many more questions that I want to ask you, but I want to make sure that the listeners know that they can ask questions too. I'm here with author Eowyn Ivey, the author of The Snow Child, and we're just talking about her book, which many people have read, and it's a very compelling book, and it raises a lot of questions that I'm sure you must have questions of your own. Your chance to talk to the author. Our show is called Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth, but we're also doing this along with the Anchorage Reads program of the Anchorage Public Library. So to get on the air, call 550-8433, 550-8433, or outside Anchorage, 1-888, that's 1-888-353-5752, and email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And I have another guest here to talk to just for a moment. Tony McPherson is with the Anchorage Public Library and is managing the Anchorage Reads program. And is this something that you do at the library every year?
My role changes. The guy that was in charge of the program this year left for a job and position in Michigan, so we stepped in.
But
to
the
manage
library,
it.
But the library is a program, you do it every year, yes?
Absolutely, for 7 years. This is the seventh year that we've done it.
Uh huh. And what are some of the events that you've got planned that are coming up? Do you have a list there?
I do, and this is the first time that we've actually had a book where the author was not only alive but present. The first one we did was Fahrenheit 451, and we did have a teleconference with Ray Bradbury, but having the author here has made such a difference. The first event that we had was a Snow Child building day on Saturday, and we had over 200 people come out, more than 40 different snowmen, and the snow was so bad that people were building them laying down, and it was what fun. It was a perfect day, and our woman was there to help judge and to sign the books, and she's agreed to be at every event, which
so,
is
so
marvelous.
They built 40, but how many were left there? I mean, did some get up and leave?
Some of them looked like they could. Okay. Some really amazing ones.
Yeah, so that was really fun, but it seems to me that the focus, because we're taking advantage of the author being here and her first book, so we are taking advantage of that by having quite a few writers' events. This Saturday there's going to be two different events. The first one's called Writing Your Place Workshop, where people can talk about their work, and that's from 10 to noon. And then at 1, there'll be a panel, and it'll include Erwin as well as Seth Cantor and several other people, and they will be talking about how they ground their writing in a particular place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's at LUSAC in
the
theater.
So just the two of you?
Actually, Don Reardon and Sherry Simpson will be joining us here.
That'll be a fantastic panel.
I'm thrilled to be on the panel with them all. It's really fabulous.
Yeah, it's really exciting to have all those people.
Give us the time and place of that again, Tony.
That's going to be from 1 to 3:45 in the Wilder Marston Theater at the LUSAC.
On Saturday,
the 9th. Huh. Then we have our finale, in which you're going to read for us, and you're going to answer questions. So it'll be like this, except it'll be face-to-face, and we're really excited about that, too, and getting our patrons to be able to come and meet you, because I think that having this kind of program, the idea is to get everybody reading the same book and talking about it,
mm-hmm.
and it and having the author in the mix is making it so much more happen. I mean, the number of books that are being checked out is phenomenal. The number of book club books that have been checked out, there's 10 books in a bag. I mean, it's really hard to keep them.
Well, you'll just have to keep patronizing Alaskan authors, Tony. There's plenty more of us out there.
Absolutely. And one of the great things, too, about this is that all the events are free. I think that's one of the wonderful things about having the library put this all on, is this is open to the public. Anyone's welcome. And it's just a really exciting thing to see people of all different ages mm-hmm. Talking about books. It's really
kind of
great.
A community building thing, Tony. Is that sort of the idea behind it?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a way of connecting. It doesn't matter how much you make, what you do for a living, or how old you are. You can attend this and you can have your perspective on this book.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back to some more discussion about the book with Eowyn Ivey, the author of The Snow Child. Now I'd like to talk to Jeannie, who's calling from Anchorage. Jeannie?
Hi there. First of all, thank you so much, Eowyn, for writing such a wonderful book. I am not born and raised in Alaska, but moved here about 14 years ago, and both my husband and I just felt so proud of you, even though we've never met you.
Oh, thank you so much.
It was just enthralling. And I must say, it took me a little while, but I want to ask you a little bit about the use of, or the non-use of, quotation marks.
Great.
When the Snow Child speaks.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question. It's been really fun because some people don't even notice that. Even very close readers have missed that, and then someone else, like in a book club, will bring it up. And that's exactly what I did. When I started out writing, Faina is one of the main characters, who is the Snow Child. And when I first started writing her dialogue and I used quote marks, I felt as if I had somehow kind of smacked her to the ground. I had just sort of ruined her magic. And it was almost as if she was shouting. She was too loud. It just wasn't working. And then I experimented with stripping out all quotation marks. I'm a big fan of Cormac McCarthy and some other authors who play with that. And that didn't feel right either. So then I kind of came up with this rule that anytime Faina was part of the conversation, there would be no quote marks. And my hope is that it would kind of preserve this ethereal quality of hers, make her conversation slightly quieter, more reserved to them. And it's been fun because apparently in the audio version, which I haven't had a chance to listen to yet, the woman who did it did a great job, from what people tell me, of imitating that without, you know, she can't show the typographical marks, but just in her voice she was able to imitate that, which was really wonderful. Mm.
Right. Well, thank you. It's, like I said, just a delightful book. I look forward to rereading it, and I look forward to hopefully some more writing from
you. Yeah. Well, thanks for the call, Jeannie. I'd be interested in, Jeannie, in hearing if you reacted to that the same way I did, which was I felt like Eowyn was signaling that that Faina might be real and might not, and that and giving us, you know, kind of holding us a little bit on the string, which kept going all the way to the last page right before the epilogue, of wondering and going back and forth.
Right, right. No, I was, yes, I would go back and reread things and think, you know, am I missing something here? I was just totally fascinated with your book. It was really delightful.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you, ma'am.
At one point, I was thinking that lack of quotation marks meant that it wasn't being expressed orally, it was inside their heads, but then I think, no, that can't be, because they can hear each other. So
yeah, no, that's really fascinating. I've had other readers use that comment as well, that it was almost like she was telepathically speaking or something, and that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And now I'd like to go to Barbara, who's calling from Homer. Barbara?
Yes, hi there. Hi, Eowyn. It's Barb from your church in Palmer.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Well, thank you. I just want to congratulate you first before I ask my questions. It's such a wonderful book, and I just really, really admired your turn of phrase when you were describing the outdoors and the snow and everything. That was just so beautiful. And just congratulations on all your world travels. That must be really exciting for you and your daughter. And then I guess my question is, I think you might have answered this when we had our own book club at the church, but anyway, there's the one character that's the owner of the store, the one that's like helps Mabel and comes to visit her family. Is that particular character based on any one person or like a conglomerate? Or?
Yeah, no, thank you. That's a good question. You know, none of the characters are based on anybody specific. In many ways, they're aspects of my own personality, which I know sounds a little strange, but I felt like I really needed to empathize with each of them. Now, some of the side characters, and I wonder if you're thinking of the Benson family, I really wanted them to sort of represent what I love about a lot of Alaskans. And so I think I've had a lot of people say, hey, I see a little bit of so-and-so in Esther or in George. And that makes me really happy because I wanted them to represent sort of that Alaskan spirit that I love so much.
Thank you. That's really great.
Yeah, I felt like that was something the book really got right, was the Alaskan kind of small town spirit, especially when Jack is injured and the neighbors come to help out. And I wonder if you get a reaction from people when you talk to people in the lower 48 or overseas to those personalities and that way of relating to each other, which seems to, I don't know if it really is unique or if it's just what we think of as being uniquely Alaskan.
You know, I think we are uniquely blessed here in a lot of ways, although I get the sense that maybe in other rural areas around the world, there's still that element of it. But I often get asked, you know, is it really like that in your neighborhood? And thankfully, I can say, yes, it is. We have a wonderful group of neighbors who, when we're gone, they come and feed our chickens and take care of our golden retriever, and we feed their horses for them, and they bring over, goodies for us and vice versa. And I'm very grateful that that's a part of my life and my daughter's life, because I don't know that it is everywhere anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, at one time it's very, very friendly and connected. At the same time, it's not particularly sophisticated or anything.
Yeah, I think that there's a very kind of down-to-earth quality to a lot of us Alaskans that I enjoy. And I was really relieved, to be honest, when Esther, the character, kind of jumped into my mind. Because as you mentioned, Mabel is quite depressed, and she can be kind of a downer. So I was glad. I think she and I were both happy when Esther popped up.
We don't know how much time we want to spend with her, right?
We need a
break every
now
and then.
Absolutely. I know
some people like that too. Well, we're going to take a break, and when I come back with Eowyn Ivey talking about her book, The Snow Child, I'm going to give out those phone numbers again, and I've got an email to read. We're going to continue our discussion of the book, and we'll be back in just 1 minute here on Hometown Alaska.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Hometown Alaska, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Hometown Alaska on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
And we're back. It's Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth, and my guest today is Eowyn Ivey, the author of The Snow Child. We're talking about the novel as part of the Anchorage Reads program that the Anchorage Public Library has put on, talking about this vision of Alaska from the 1920s, the people involved, the emotions and the magic in the book. It's really a book that's caught a lot of people's imagination, and many people are reading it. And we've had some interesting questions today. And so if you want to get on the air or send an email to get your question in or your comment for Eowyn, this next half hour is the time to do it. The phone number here in Anchorage is 550-8433, 550-8433. Or from outside Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752. Email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And I have an email here from Jim in Wasilla, who asks, what is your opinion of publishing online versus paper? I am an aspiring author, encouraged to get published online versus paperback.
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. It's certainly a really up-and-coming, changing face of publishing right now. And my book is available in an ebook format as well as in the more traditional format. And it's a tough question for me because as a bookseller, I want everyone to turn out to their independent bookstores and buy a hardcover or a paperback. And at the same time, digital media has just opened up so many doors for authors and publishers. And so I think it really depends on the type of book you're writing and and how you want to get it out there and how much time you have to do your own marketing. If you're looking at self-publishing, it's a lot of work, I think, to do that, but lots of people have been tremendously successful at it. With my publisher, Little Brown, I'm fortunate that they put a lot of effort behind it and a lot of talent and expertise that I don't have to kind of help get the word out about a book. So I think it's really great to just kind of look online. There's lots of blogs and websites that are talking about the pros and cons, and just kind of check it out and investigate a little bit.
I think part of it goes to your goals as an author. Is your goal simply to see your words out there and you don't care too much how many people read them? You know, if that's the case, then the electronic self-publishing versions are amazing and a wonderful thing. If you really want to make your living in any way or have your words read by a large number of people, you need to be part of a system that gets the books out there. And that's what publishers still are able to do.
Absolutely. Yep, definitely.
So you've been pretty happy with your publisher and the job.
I am. I just feel tremendously. I'm actually with Reagan Arthur Imprints, which is a subprint of Little Brown. And they've just tremendous support. You know, they do that job of getting the book into hands that I couldn't get them into. Oprah Magazine and Barnes & Noble and Amazon and independent booksellers around the country. So that they, because part of the problem is just letting people know that your book even exists. I think that's the biggest battle because, you know, they can't decide if they like it or not if they don't even know it's out there.
And are they able to obtain it once they know they want it?
Right.
You know, in sort of the spur of the moment buying.
Absolutely. And that is one of the advantages that I see happening with ebooks is that there is sort of this instantaneous gratification. You think of a book you want and you just push the button and you can get it. Fortunately now, a lot of independent booksellers are kind of getting together and offering ebooks through them, which is a really wonderful thing. So it's not kind of consolidated so much in just certain areas.
Oh, I like that idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I have to admit, I read this book electronically, same reason I needed it right now. And so I don't have it to put on the shelf or have you to sign it.
Yeah, and that is that's one of the downsides, I think, is just that kind of sense of a keepsake that you want. Mm-hmm. Although I have heard of some authors signing with a permanent marker, e-readers.
Wow, I don't know about that. Yeah. So, and you said you're a bookseller. Do you still work there?
You know, I actually eventually kind of had to leave, mainly because I was only working maybe 15 hours a week part-time, and I was having to ask for basically every 15 hours off so that I had a lot of travel come up unexpectedly. Mm-hmm. I feel really fortunate to have this continued relationship with Fireside Books. We've done events together, and I very much feel like it's a second home still.
Yeah, that's great. Matt is calling from Anchorage with a question about publishing. Matt?
Ewan, it's my understanding that this book was published overseas in foreign languages before it hit the press here. And I'm curious how that worked out and who translated it and how that sequence worked out that it was more popular in Europe before it started making the rounds here.
Yeah, that was such a surprise for me. I think, you know, coming from a bookseller background, I felt like I had a sense of how publishing worked, and then I kept getting surprised again and again. So what happened is that when Little Brown acquired it here in the U.S., there were similar deals with publishers, mostly in Europe at that point. And so Norway, the U.K., Spain, Italy, France were some of the earlier. And it's hard to explain, but each one is just a separate publishing deal. So my agent, you know, and the publishers come up with those deals, and then what happens is they get to decide when they're going to publish. They have their own translators that translate it. I really have very little to do with it. And oftentimes, I haven't even really seen what it's going to look like until a box of books shows up on my door. My UK publisher is a very different situation. I've worked very closely with them, and they're just a tremendous headline as the publisher there. But yeah, and I think we're up to, it's just astounding. I think we're at like 25 foreign translations and 30-some countries it's being distributed to. But it's really, I wish I could take credit for it, but I really can't. Once the ball starts rolling, there are foreign agents who are looking at it, and then the publishers decide when to release it in their country.
And so the fact that it came out in the other countries faster than the United States was strictly choices those publishing companies made and not anything you had anything to do with.
Right, precisely. And actually, I mean, to be honest, it was a little excruciating to wait for it to come out in the U.S. I was really anxious, you know, to know how was it going to be received. But Little Brown's schedule, they have, you know, their own plan for when they want to release certain books, when they think the market will be good for those books. And they wanted to wait till February. So, you know, it came out in Norway. And I think it was simultaneously released in the U.S. and the U.K. So, yeah, it's a very, you don't have a whole lot of control as an author over things like covers and translations. It kind of takes on a life of its own at that point.
Well, congratulations on 25 languages.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, it's amazing.
Good question,
thank you.
Matt. Thanks for calling. You know, I had the experience of having one of my books translated into French, and I have the impression the translation isn't very good because people look at me strangely.
You're wondering what they're saying.
I was actually in France signing books, and somebody picked up and said, "This is a very difficult book, isn't it?" And I don't know if they did a very good job. I'll never know.
Right.
I'm interested in your perception of your audience, you know, when you're writing. And I had the feeling, you know, from a book's publishing standpoint, they would sort of pigeonhole this as a women's book. And I enjoyed the book. You know, there was a little bit more about her wedding dress than I was really that interested in. But, I mean, do you have a person in mind that you're writing to or an audience in mind when you're sitting, I don't know if you write by hand or at the computer?
Yeah. No, that's a great question, too. I do work at a computer. And I had hoped, I do think that there... that it could easily be kind of labeled a women's fiction. And I think in part because women, not to diss men, but women are the bigger readers of novels. They are the ones doing book clubs. They're reading a lot. So I think novels tend to actually end up... but I had really hoped that it would appeal to both men and women. I very much wanted my male character, Jack, to be believable and identifiable for men. And I wanted some of the things having to do with hunting and trapping and fishing to maybe appeal to some men who wouldn't otherwise, as you say, connect with the wedding dress. But when I write, and this sounds very self-centered, I'm actually writing like I want to write a book that I want to read. And I guess that's kind of where it comes from. My husband and my daughter and my mom actually were my first readers, and I would share chapters with them regularly. And they all had great different perspectives. But ultimately, I want to write a book that I want to read. And I read a lot, so I like lots of different kinds of books. And that was kind of what was driving me as I wrote
mm-hmm,
it.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about why Jack is so secretive and doesn't. I mean, we know, obviously, when they've lost their child, there's an emotional barrier there and they're not able to connect. And that's an issue that's understandable in the way men and women relate. But then when they start having these experiences with the snow child, he keeps things kind of to himself that you would think that he would share with her. And What do you see in his personality that makes that happen?
Right. Well, I think there's a couple of factors. One is I did see their marriage as being very damaged in terms of their ability to communicate. And I think that he misunderstood Mabel and felt like he needed to protect her from things that would be, you know, emotionally damaging. But also,
In other words, she's depressed. Let's not make it any
worse.
Yeah,
right, right. Mm-hmm. And let's not throw anything strange into her life. She can't handle it. And it was a certain level of disrespect, I think, that he showed her in that. But I think it was the nature of their relationship. But also, I wanted to be true to the times. And I think that from what I've read and talking to older people, I think in the 1920s, it was very common for couples to just not talk about things, to not have that level of intimacy and sharing and communication that has become much more acceptable and wanted in relationships. And I wanted that to change as the course of the book went on. I wanted them to realize that they needed each other and that they needed to share with each other to make it together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it struck me that you alluded to tone a little bit earlier, and that there is a sense of the tone being, and I don't know if this was a conscious choice, but there is a little bit of a 1920s tone to the book in terms of the style of books that were being written at that time, and obviously the way the characters would express themselves, you would try to have it in their colloquial language, but also the tone of your expression as the narrator is somewhat to that time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I wanted to, and I tried, and you know, I don't know if it's noticeable or not, if I succeeded, but the chapters that I wrote that were through Jack's eyes, even though they're not in first person, I wanted the language, the narration, the things he observes to be accurate to who he was at that time. And same with Mabel. So I did. It is funny how it seems like books, once you start writing a project, whether it's a short story or a newspaper article, whatever it is, it starts to develop a nature that you want to be true to. And I think that happened to me as I was writing
mm-hmm.
it.
Well, it seems like you're really well read. Have you read popular fiction from that era to sort of orient yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually much more a modern novel fan. I read a lot. I'm constantly reading the new books that come out. I did read The Great Gatsby very recently. I'm sometimes ashamed at some of the classics I haven't read, and I really enjoyed it. And I am always kind of, and I was researching then too, and I was reading newspaper articles from that time and different things. So I would hope that some of that sort of seeped through as I was writing.
Yeah, well, Chickaloon has a little bit of a 1920s feel to it, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yeah, it has a very long, interesting history, actually, in terms of the trains, the railroad, and the mines there, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, let me give out these numbers again. We've got about 10 or 15 minutes left with Eowyn Ivey talking about the Snow Child. The number, if you're in Anchorage, is 550-8433. From outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. My name is Charles Wolfert. The show is Hometown Alaska. Eowyn, it struck me as I was reading this book that there was a tremendous cinematic potential here in the movement, the change in the characters. There's plenty of action. There's an outdoors, almost a Western feel to it. Is that something that is developing or happening, or what's going on with that?
Yeah, you know, currently there isn't anything definite going on. To be honest, I have very mixed feelings about it being made into a movie. I mean, it's kind of, in ways, sort of it seems like every author's dream, you know, to have a movie made of it.
And you make a lot of money that way.
Yeah, it does. And it tends to spur sales of the book and mm-hmm. all that. But at the same time, it's a little bit nerve-wracking to imagine how would it be interpreted. I have had some talks with some different filmmakers, and I'm kind of letting my agents guide me in that discussion right now. And so we haven't accepted anything, and we're just kind of, I think, just waiting to see. I think it's got to be the right situation to make it happen. But I am very excited to say that there's actually a UK composer who's making an opera based on it.
Wow.
And I'm really thrilled about that. My daughter is actually an up-and-coming opera singer, if I may say so, and we're very interested in opera. And at first, I was sort of surprised. I thought, trying to imagine it as an opera, but the more I think about it, the more excited I am. And so it's something he's in the process of putting together right now.
Oh, that's marvelous. I mean, that brings me to a question I was going to ask. Is you've been all over the world with the book, and especially in the UK. Do readers respond to it differently there? Do they have a different lens for coming to the book? Do they have different questions for you?
Yeah, occasionally, but not as much as I expected, to be honest. One of the things that has been really wonderful for me is I get emails, and I've talked with readers from, you know, remote parts of Australia and remote parts of Scotland and places, Norway, that they really identify with a lot of the sort of open landscape and wilderness. I didn't expect that, to be honest. But there are some things specifically about the hunting and the trapping and the notion of actually eating a moose heart, those sorts of things that people are sort of flabbergasted by.
Love it, don't they? I mean, especially, you know, especially in Germany and some European countries, that there's a huge mystique about that sort of
Absolutely.
Thing.
No, there is. And I think that's one of the fortunate things. I don't know that we can write to market. I don't mm-hmm. know. But I happen to be lucky enough that I want to write about Alaska. I'm from Alaska, and there's just tremendous interest in Alaska around the world. And I absolutely think that has helped drive some of the interest in the book.
Well, you're fortunate enough that Alaska doesn't kind of stamp out your story. And it seems like a lot of times people try to write about Alaska and it's just too big for their book, you know, and the characters disappear. But that doesn't seem to have happened to you.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, it is. It is. And I don't know if part of it's just that this is my, you know, I feel like all of us who live here, this is my landscape. It's just a part mm-hmm. of, but it was very much a part of what I wanted to express and share. And it is tricky to balance that with a plot line and characters. And
mm-hmm. Now, being a successful author has made you into a very public person. And were you comfortable talking, going on the radio, being in front of groups before? Have you had to change at all in terms of your way of being around other people?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I had a lot of experience working with the public, but from the other side of the microphone, so to speak, the other side of the notebook. As a newspaper reporter, I was very comfortable interviewing people and talking to strangers. It is different, though, when you're talking about your own life and you're, asked questions about what you kind of consider your art or how you express yourself. It can be kind of a funny experience. But I think I've gotten more comfortable with it. And we're trying as a family to figure out that balance of how much of our private lives to share. Part of the interest in the book in other countries is about Alaska. So trying to figure out that balance of how much we share of our own lives.
A reporter might want to come to your home or that kind of thing.
Yeah, there have been some things like that. Luckily, everything so far has kind of been within our comfort zone. And the truth is, in ways, it's a wonderful experience. I mean, my 5-year-old daughter got to come to Australia with my husband and meet me there. My mom and my oldest daughter met me in Europe, and we got to see Paris together. So there's just some wonderful opportunities. But it is pretty life-altering in ways that we have to kind of shift as a family mm-hmm. and make adaptations for.
Well, I was going to ask that. I mean, all this travel seems like it could get kind of old when you have kids at home.
Well, yeah, and I start to get these little panic attacks when I think about getting on an airplane, to be honest. I've spent a lot of time. I realized that during that 5-week international tour, I think I was in an airplane for 80 hours during that time, and I do not like airplanes. But it has been a lot of travel, and I think now that I've done that, I've had to start turning things down a little bit. I mean, what a wonderful situation to be in as an author, to get so many invitations. But I have to sort of refocus on my own life a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And you're writing?
Yeah, and I am working on another novel, which is another impetus to sort of buckle down a little bit and stay home some more. And I'm very excited about it. It's still early in the process, but yeah.
Does that put a lot of pressure on you, knowing, I mean, when you were writing your first novel that never saw the light of day, you didn't have to worry about many, many, many people reading it. Now you do.
Yeah, it is. It's a completely different. When I was writing The Snow Child, I was in my little closet office. The only people that knew that I was even working on it were my closest friends and my family. And now it is I feel much more like I'm writing in the public, which is one hand a blessing and on the other hand a little nerve-wracking.
Uh-huh. Do you feel there's a supportive literary community here, and what kind of help have you gotten?
Oh, absolutely. I actually think, and my agent said this after he was here for the Kachemak Bay Writers Conference when we met. He said, you have some amazing writers up there, and I really believe it. And I think 49 writers with Andromeda, Romano Lax and Deb Vanasse, people like Seth Kantner and Don Reardon and John Straley and Sherry Simpson. I mean, there's just amazing writers in Alaska. The very writers that have inspired me to want to write along the way as I was reading. And it's thrilling to have people come together like the panel that we're getting ready to do to kind of support each other and cheer each other's books on. It's a very wonderful mm-hmm. atmosphere.
Well, just in case people don't know about 49 Writers, it's a website for and of writers and with literary events, and you can actually be a member of the organization. It's 49 Writers, numeral 49 writers.blogspot.com. And if I remember, I'll try to get that put on the website at Alaska Public. .org. There's a ton of information at alaskapublic.org about you and Ivy's book, The Snow Child, reviews and link to her blog and her website. Also information about Anchorage Reads and other material you might want to find. So just go to alaskapublic.org and scroll down to the headline, Anchorage Reads The Snow Child for Hometown Alaska. We've just got a few minutes left. I'm Charles Woolforth, and it's Hometown Alaska. I want to talk one more time to Tony McPherson, who is with the Anchorage Public Library, about the events that are coming up. I'm not sure if we covered the whole program, and we probably have different listeners listening to us right now. The Public Library puts together this Anchorage Reads program with the concept that many people around town are going to read the same book and then be able to talk about it and share it. And the book this year is a really good choice of Eowyn Ivey's The Snow Child. It sounds like people really are checking into this, Tony.
Yeah, they are. They're really excited about it. And as an interesting sign, we gave away prizes at the snow thing, when we had the snowman building thing. And so many people said, I don't want the sled, I want the book. Which the author to sign it right there. One event that I did not mention is UAA has invited a woman, a doctor or a professor up, and her name is Kanovian, and she is going to lecture about the Snow Maiden tale in Russian folklore, literature, and music and art, which is sort of what this novel was based on. It's a free lecture Monday the 18th from 5 to 7 in the bookstore. And that was one that I didn't mention before.
At the UAA bookstore.
Correct. And then this coming weekend, which we're really excited about, are the two writers' workshops. The first is Writing Your Place, led by Douglas Bourne. And then a panel with people talking about how they ground their writing in a particular place, and that includes Eowyn and Seth Kantner and Don Reardon and Sherry Simpson.
How do you decide what you're going to put into you're choosing the book? I mean, every book group, that's the hottest discussion, right, is what's the next book. Do you have a committee that does that or something?
We do have a committee, but it's different members every time, it seems like. And this time we tried to get a broader input from the community versus the library side. Mm-hmm. And your book was just coming out, and everybody was so amazed and astounded by its popularity. And they said, we have to celebrate this book, and let's find out how it was done. Because mm-hmm. we're Alaskans too, you know. It's an Alaska book we wanted to celebrate.
Yeah, well, I think it's exciting for all Alaskans when one of our own really hits one out of the park. So we just have a couple of minutes left, Ewan, and I thought it would be a good place to finish up to talk about kind of your view of life, in a sense, and that you have a hopeful outlook on the world. I mean, this book is very hopeful, and I mean, in reality, you know, imaginary or snow people don't show up. Is there an inner truth that you feel like you're talking about there?
Yeah, and I'm so glad you came away feeling that way, because there are some very hard things in the book, mm-hmm. and it starts out quite depressing, I think. But I do. I have a lot of hope, and I guess ultimately I believe in things like love and family and neighbors and community, and I think that's what gets us through. And I also very much believe in the beauty of Alaska, but in its complexity. I don't think it's something that should be just looked at sort of in a postcard vision that we often see from outside. I think that to love it is to kind of understand it on many levels, which includes death and suffering, but also lots of lovely
mm-hmm.
things.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me like Faina is almost a personified Alaska, because she has this lovely, beautiful feeling, but she's also holds at a distance, and she's also has quite a brutal way of killing a swan.
Yeah, no, and again, that's really wonderful insight. I haven't had very many readers pick up on that, and I'm really glad, because I didn't want to lose her to being a metaphor. I think that's the one danger sometimes with characters, is I wanted her to seem magically real still, but I did very much want to explore the persona of Alaska in her.
Mm-hmm. I hope that's not a bad sign that she disappears at the end.
You know, but it's funny. And that's, we didn't quite get into the ending a whole lot. But I guess whatever her fate was, I hope that in the sense of the falling snow and her, some of the other things that are indicated at the end, the sense is that she may be gone in the form that we knew her, but that maybe she's still there in some other ways.
Sure. She could always come back.
There won't be a sequel, though.
Right, yeah. We'll wait to see how that
snow
first
Child
movie
too,
goes.
Right?
Right?
No.
But I mean, she does. There is not a sense of finality because all these other new family members are there, and there's a sort of sense that the whole sort of the circle of life is continuing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was what I it was sort of an inevitability. I felt like that she was going to leave in the end. I felt like both by the nature of the fairy tale and also just the nature of reality, it was that it wasn't going to last. But thank you so much.
Oh well, thank you for being here. This has really been fun. It is a great book, and I know that all of our listeners haven't listened to it, and there's a lot more to enjoy in the book that we haven't talked about. My guest has been Ewan Ivey, the author of The Snow Child, and Tony McPherson from the Anchorage Public Library. My name is Charles Wolforth. The next week on Hometown Alaska, join host Kathleen McCoy to talk about winter ravens. That's a great topic. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. You can join us on Facebook at Alaska Public. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400.